Images of Muslim women have been much in the news in recent years, beginning with the photos of women in full-body burqas before the Taliban fell in Afghanistan in 2001. In some societies, Islam has been used to justify the oppression of women. My next guest, Keisha Ali, directs the Islam section of the Feminist Sexual Ethics Project at Brandeis University. She did not grow up Muslim. She grew up nominally Christian and then atheist and converted to Islam in early adulthood. But before she was Muslim, she says, she was feminist. And from the first, she has worked to reconcile these aspects of her identity.
For someone who has considered herself a feminist since she knew what the word meant, I can't really say that everything made sense immediately. There were some sticking points for me. There were some sticking points in the Quranic text, and more particularly, there was a big sense that somehow there was just something about Islam that was different. And how could you be a feminist and a Muslim, and how could you reconcile those two things? Because it was absolutely necessary for me to reconcile them if I was going to convert. And the reality is that I don't think I have made my peace with everything contained in Islamic religious texts, and certainly not with everything that transpires in Muslim communities. Mm-hmm. But the rest of the world isn't a feminist paradise either. And I found the overall core of Islam, the overall core of the Quran's message, to be so convincingly egalitarian that the rest seemed to be, in some sense, just details.
As Keisha Ali worked to reconcile her Islamic faith with her concerns as a woman, she found herself drawn to the wisdom of early Islamic jurists, especially from the 9th century. This was a period of intellectual ferment in Islam and lively debate on how the revealed law of the Quran could be applied to changing social realities. Here is an example of one such text.
Ash-Shafi'i, may God be merciful to him, said, "The Book of God, great and majestic, and the Sunnah of the Messenger of God, peace be upon him, indicate that the man must support his wife." Ash-Shafi'i said, "If it is among her rights due from him that he support her, and it is among his rights to derive enjoyment from her, and if it is that each one of the spouses has a corresponding right over the other spouse, what the husband has is a right over the wife, and what the wife has is a right over the husband. This implies that if the man cannot find the means to support her, he should not have the right to retain her, deriving enjoyment from her and keeping others away from her, compelling her to make do with him alone, and preventing her from moving about the town while he does not find the means to support her. Thus, if he cannot find the means to maintain her, she should be given the option between staying with him or separating from him."
I asked Keisha Ali why she, as a 21st century feminist, felt compelled to engage ancient scholarship.
Well, if you're Muslim, then revealed law has to govern your life. You have to figure out when it's literally applicable and when it's not. And there has not been a tremendously sophisticated 21st century, even 20th century, attempt to do that. But the further back you go, up to a certain point, to the 9th century, the 10th century, the 12th century, you find people really engaged in systematic reflection on the sources of law, the Quran, and also the traditions of the Prophet, to attempt to really faithfully figure out what rules can be deduced from them to regulate Muslim lives and Muslim families and Muslim communities. And so while I don't necessarily think that the rules that they came up with in the 9th century are necessarily applicable to me in the 21st century, since so many other things are different, nonetheless, there hasn't been a comparable attempt recently. And I think that we have to really engage with what these, I guess, founding fathers is an overused term, but I think it applies here, with what these people did, because so much of the past practice of the community derives from that and so much of its legitimacy and its authority.
So tell me how your study of these sources is illuminating the questions that you find really important today in terms of women in Islam, in relationship with men, in marriage, sexuality and divorce, this sort of complex of issues.
You know, the thing that's most striking to me in reading these texts from the 9th century is that their understanding of marriage and the family is very different than what most conservative Muslims talk about today. You know, you find people writing things about, you know, the Muslim husband and father who goes out and earns a living and supports his dependents and as such has these responsibilities. And the Quran can tell us that when it says, you know, men are qawamun in relation to women, they're breadwinners or they're protectors or they're maintainers. That's not how the early jurists understood this. A man had an obligation to support his wife because she permitted him to control her mobility and she made herself sexually available to him. That's the legal understanding of this. Mm-hmm. And the jurists interpret scriptural passages and prophetic traditions to that end. Now, a man has an obligation to support his children also for a variety of other reasons, but wife and children are not a unit as dependents in this nuclear family. They're talking about something very different when they talk about marriage and family. And today, I think we have just failed to recognize that it's a very different relationship. Now, none of this takes into account the fact that in many places in the Muslim world historically, and especially today, women earn incomes, particularly in the lower classes, and often those incomes are very necessary to support their family. Mm-hmm. So even this rhetoric of male providership does not necessarily reflect the situation on the ground, as it were.
In our minds, I believe, in this country, we have certain images of women in Islam. There are some obvious things which seem to jump out as the problems, and one of them would be the veil. You actually note in this article I read that wearing traditional dress in some Muslim cultures is not a continuation of tradition, but sort of a new trend that I'm inferring also has new meanings that are modern. Talk to me about that.
Really, I think that traditional dress, the hijab, is perceived as being this ever-changing, non-negotiable, and sort of all-important component of Muslim women's lives. And in fact, the reality is that for many people, it still is absolutely vital. I was at a conference recently, and when the issue of wearing hijab came up, one of the other panelists essentially said that denying the necessity for women to wear hijab is tantamount to apostasy. Now, apostasy is a tremendously serious issue for Muslims. Mm-hmm. It's not something to be taken lightly. And what bothered me most was not so much that this was raised as that it, in fact, ignited the most passionate and the most ardent and the most enthusiastic and interested and engaged and longest exchange of any topic that had been raised at this conference that was ostensibly about the Prophet Muhammad.
And the people who were engaged, were these Muslim women or Muslim men and women?
Well, this was a man who made the remark, but all of the Muslim women virtually at the conference wore hijab, and actually none of the three scholars on the panel did, which was what prompted the question in the first place from one of the audience members. But the women had a slightly different perspective. Their perspective was, and many of them approached me privately following this session, was that, yes, it has to be a choice for women to make. Yes, it's something that is a difficult choice to make. It can also be tremendously rewarding to do it, but that, you know, this is not the most important thing.
Do you wear a hijab?
I do not.
Okay.
And that wasn't an easy decision also. You know, I do dress modestly, mm-hmm. and I think that for myself, you know, the determination that I have made is that living in the United States in the 21st century, the criterion for modesty are different, and that the point of the Quranic injunctions is to make women's appearance less the focus of attention and women's bodies less the subject of sexualization and commodification. And head covering in the United States, to me, seems to attract more attention. On the other hand, I have plenty of close Muslim friends who do cover their hair, and it's not an issue between us.
Keisha Ali. She is senior research analyst for the Islam section of the Feminist Sexual Ethics Project at Brandeis. The Prophet Muhammad was a married man several times over. I asked Keisha Ali how this living model of marriage in Islamic tradition shapes her modern experience of family and marriage.
The Prophet Muhammad had a number of wives,
yeah.
Although he was married to one woman for a very long period of time, about 25 years, according to traditional accounts. And she is the mother of all of his surviving children, four daughters. And in fact, she was his only wife during that time. She was his first wife. And many Muslim women today say, you know, that is really the model that we need to be most concerned with. That is the partnership marriage that gives us the best indication of how the Prophet lived and behaved as a husband. On the other hand, what most of the Quran talks about and what most of the traditions that deal with the Prophet and his wives talk about are his subsequent marriages, mm-hmm. because that was the time when he was leading a community in Medina and consolidating alliances with other clans and with other tribes. And those were the marriages that were really central in cementing those kinds of relationships between Muhammad and other community leaders and other prominent men within and outside of his tribe. And the marriages of his daughters to some of those men also helped cement
those
ties. Isn't it also
interesting that he had four daughters?
Yes, yes.
It is. I knew that, but when you said it, it was a striking image to me.
Well, very much so. And I think that particularly as daughters, this is off the topic of marriage a little bit, but there is a tremendous amount actually in the Quran and in the prophetic tradition about recognizing the worth of daughters, of certainly not killing them, because that was, at least according to the Quran, a practice of the pre-Islamic Arabs, that female infanticide was practiced, and the Quran condemns that in the strongest possible terms. It also condemns men being joyful at the news of the birth of a son and saddened at the birth of a daughter. Hmm. And it says, you know, if your choice is between female infanticide and being saddened at the birth of a daughter but joyful at the birth of a son, that's an evil choice. You know, having to decide between those two extremes, you should be joyful, the implication is, at the birth of a daughter. So there is definitely a strong sense in which this preference for sons over daughters is not recognized and not legitimated by the foundational texts of Muslim tradition. Although, of course, it continues to be practiced many places in the Muslim world, as well as many other places.
Yes, and at this period in which the Prophet was consolidating his civic and political leadership, then he was married to
nine women.
Nine women, okay.
Nine women at the time he died.
That's another red flag.
That's a huge problem.
Right.
Yep.
Now, I want to know how you think about that problem, how you put it into perspective to worry about or not to worry about.
Well, the first thing is, I don't think polygyny specifically, having more than one wife, has ever been a huge problem in the Muslim world for the simple reason of demographics. You know, you cannot have polygamy as the norm because there simply aren't four women, which is the limit that the Quran puts on the number of wives for any man but the Prophet. You cannot have a society where you have 80% women and 20% men and every man has four wives. It just has not historically worked that way. Polygyny has been restricted to wealthy men for the most part through most of its history. It's not necessarily limited to the Muslim world in the sense that you find polygamous marriages many other places in Africa, for example. Mm-hmm. And you find really de facto polygamy or polygyny in lots of places. Wealthy white American men, for example, taking mistresses. For example, the practice of trophy wives, divorce the first wife who supported you through graduate school and, you know, marry your graduate student once you've become the professor.
Right.
Or the wife who supported you through medical school and then you marry a nurse. I mean, this happens in our culture. And what happens is the first wife is divorced. When polygamy is practiced in the Muslim world, what often happens is the second woman is married, but the first wife is not divorced. That all said, I would not want my own marriage to be polygamous. And obviously, living in the United States, that's not a big issue for me. But it would be, potentially, if I lived other places in the Muslim world.
You mentioned that there was a dower amount in your marriage contract. Mm-hmm. I mean, that just sounds old-fashioned in American ears. But it has more significance than that, doesn't it, for you?
Well, it's a legal requirement for Muslim marriage. And to tell you the truth, I wanted to simply waive it and have just a symbolic amount. And my in-laws insisted that that would not do, that it would be very embarrassing not to have dower. And so I had a cash amount as well as gold jewelry that was given to me by my husband.
Right. And this is something that's given to the wife from the husband.
From the husband. And it's her sole property. And he has no control over what she does with it. And it's very, very important for a lot of Muslim women as a means of securing a certain amount of financial independence. Now, it's also possible, although this was not the case in my marriage, to defer part of the dower till death or divorce. Hmm. And that is, if the husband divorces the wife without her assent, then she gets, I've seen contracts, for example, for $250,000 deferred dower.
Sort of like a Muslim prenuptial agreement that's tilted towards the interest of the woman.
That's very much what it is.
Muslim feminist Keisha Ali. Today on Speaking of Faith, we're exploring three different feminist perspectives on women, marriage, and religion in our time. Keisha Ali has been talking about Islamic tradition and women's lives. I asked her how she has come to understand the overriding ethos of Islam towards marriage and the relationship between men and women.
The Quran says, اتقوا ربكم الذي خلقكم من نفس واحدة وخلق منها زوجها وبث منهما رجالا كثيرا ونساء. Revere your Lord who created you from a single soul, نفس واحدة, and created from it its mate. وَخَلَقَ مِنْهَا زَوْجَهَا. It's literally created from her, because soul is a feminine word in Arabic, her mate. وَبَثَ مِنْهُمَا, and from them spread رِجَالٌ كَثِيرٌ وَنِسَاءٌ, many men and women. So this is a very important verse. It's the first verse in the chapter of the Quran entitled Women, Surah An-Nisa. It puts God first and foremost. Revere God. Maybe it puts humanity's worship of God first and foremost. Then it says, who created you from a single soul and created from this soul its mate, right? Its spouse. Mm-hmm. Now, many translations of the Quran say, you know, God created man from a single soul and created his wife. But that isn't what the Quran says. In fact, I was once at a wedding where the man performing the ceremony read this verse in Arabic and then said, and the English translation of this is God created Adam. And out of Adam created Eve.
Did you stand up and say something?
I didn't. I bit my lip, but it was killing me to do it. So this, to me, is fundamentally how we have to understand marriage as the pairing of a male and female. And that concept of pairs and the concept of being created of the same soul and for each other is tremendously important. And I think that any discussion of marriage has to begin there. The Quran also says spouses are garments for one another. And it says men and women are each other's awliya, friends or protectors. So those verses provide a very important starting place. On the other hand, the Quran also has some verses that regulate specifics of marriage and divorce that seem to give men some type of advantage over their wives. For example, there is a verse that says women have rights from men, like the rights that men have from women, and men have a degree above them or a degree against them or an advantage over them. And people have discussed a lot what it is that that degree is. Is it simply that men have greater financial resources? Is the degree one of preference or is it one of responsibility? And, you know, people have gone back and forth over this for years and years and years and centuries and centuries. But, you know, the basic relationship is one of reciprocity and mutuality, tempered very much by hierarchy, and that hierarchy is there in the Quranic text. The question then becomes, is it essential and is it always applicable or is it subject to change if historical circumstances change?
This way that you wrestle with the texts and find your way through them and apply modern realities and the circumstances of your culture to these ancient teachings. Do you think that yours is a particularly American way of being a Muslim woman? Do you feel that Muslim women in other countries and cultures are also wrestling with these subjects in the same way, are able to do that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that, in fact, there are many who've given it far more profound thought than I have, who have done really incredible work. I mean, there are women writing in the 19th century in Egypt in the women's press dealing with some of these kinds of issues. Mm. You know, I think that any complicated text like the Quran admits numerous interpretations, and one is absolutely a patriarchal one. And there is also, I think, an equally plausible feminist or at the very least egalitarian reading. And I think that from that perspective, you know, we have to be willing to allow conversations about these kinds of issues to take place within the Muslim community and not simply dismiss them.
You have three children, right? Is one or more of them a daughter?
I have two girls and a boy.
Okay. And I'm curious if they also are aware of some of these, let's say, stereotypes about Muslim women that are out there in our culture, and if you talk to them about your work and if they're already thinking on these things themselves. They're pretty young, aren't they?
They are young. The oldest is seven. And so I don't think that they're really aware yet of the kinds of stereotypes about Muslim women that permeate much of American culture. I do things like, for example, not use a male pronoun when I'm talking about God, things like that, because I think that children do particularly create mental pictures, and I think that becomes much less possible if you don't talk about God as he. And so they say things like, I'm thinking of someone with my four-year-old, and, you know, one of the first questions that comes up is male or female, and I asked her male or female, and she said, well, neither. Because she was thinking about God. God was the person she had thought of. And, you know, she couldn't put a gender to God, which was phenomenal to me that at least at that very basic level, I have had an impact in thinking about how she thinks about God. So, you know, she's four. We'll see in future years.